If he was, he's gone to the Jack Oak Woods to heal himself. The Lord shows his creatures how to do. If he ain't dead now, he'll come limping home powerful hungry in time. Tomorrow or day after, the boy asked. Longer. Maybe 4 days, or more like 7. But don't be all hope, child. If he had deep head wounds, he might be out of crazy and not know where he'd wandered off to die. The boy's mother had brought home the empty meal sack. In her basket, she had some fat meat, potatoes, and a small bottle of vanilla flavoring, which she had bought with the money she got for her walnut kernels. From the bottom of the basket, she took the folded brown paper bag into which she poured each night's pickings and put it on the shelf. She also brought home an empty cardboard box which the storekeeper had given her. She didn't say where she'd been besides the store or what had happened. The boy could see that her eyes were filled with hurt and said nothing. The younger children remembered not to ask anything, except looking into the empty box, one said,
"Nothing in here?"
"I'm going to use it to put a cake in," the mother said. "Better go out crack nuts for the nice picking for dark," she said to the boy. The boy scooped up a tin pail of nuts from the big box under the stove and went out to the flat cracking stone. With his knees still sore from crawling under the cabin, he hesitated a long time before he knelt on the frozen earth. Standing, he looked one way and then another, tracing the fence rows that had more oaks than the other trees, the far lowland woods, and the foothills. "I'll go there first tomorrow," he said to himself as he faced the foothills. "There's big patches of oak trees there." And whenever Sounder was given his head, he picked the hills for hunting. When night came, his mother hummed and picked kernels. She did not tell a story. The boy wanted to ask who carried in wood to keep the people in jail warm. He knew they had big stoves in big jails. Once, his mother had told him a story about three people named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who were in jail. Some mean governor or sheriff got mad and had them thrown right in the jail stove, big as a furnace. But the Lord blew out the fire and cooled the big stove in a second. And when the jail keeper opened the stove door, there stood Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego singing, "Cool water, cool water, the Lord's got green pastures and cool water." Tell me about Joseph in the jail in the stone quarry in Egypt and chiseling out rocks to make old Pharaoh's gravestone, the boy asked. But his mother went on humming, and the boy went back to his thinking. No stove could be that big, he thought. He watched the red coals through the open draft in the stove door brighten each time the wind blew loud enough to make a low whistling noise in the stovepipe. A burning chunk stick fell against the inside of the stove, but the boy did not try to convince himself that it might be the thump of Sounder scratching fleas underneath the floor. He was thinking of tomorrow. Tomorrow, he would go into the woods and look for Sounder. "The wind whistling in the pipe is bothersome," he said. He hated the cold wind. It blew through his clothes and chilled his body inside and made him shiver. He hoped the wind would not be blowing in the woods tomorrow. The wind made the woods noisy. The boy liked the woods when they were quiet. He understood quiet. He could hear things in quiet. But quiet was better in the woods than it was in the cabin. He didn't hear things in cabin quiet. Cabin quiet was long and sad. "Turn the pipe damper a little and the whistling will stop," his mother said at last. The next day, he walked the great woodlands, calling Sounder's name. The wind blew through his clothes and chilled him inside. When he got home after dark, his clothes were torn. His throat hurt with a great lump choking him. His mother fed him and said, "Child, child, you must not go into the woods again. Sounder might come home again, but you must learn to lose, child. The Lord teaches the old to lose. The young don't know how to learn it. Some people is born to keep, some is born to lose. We was born to lose, I reckon. But Sounder might come back. But weeks went by, and Sounder did not come back. One night, the boy learned why his mother had brought home the bottle of vanilla flavoring. Now it was Christmas, and she was making a cake. When the four layers were spread out on the tin-topped table and she began to ice them, the boy noticed that she put three together in a large cake and made a small one of the leftover layer. "Why are we having two cakes?" the boy asked. But she was humming to herself and did not answer him. When she had finished, she put the small cake on the top shelf of the dish cupboard. The big one she put in the cardboard box she had brought from the store. The sweet smell of baking and vanilla had drawn the smaller children from the stove to the edge of the table. The woman reached over or walked around them as she worked. "I'm done," she finally said. "You can lick the pans." The boy had not moved from his chair by the stove. Today he had searched the oak clumps along the far fence rows for Sounder. He never got the sweet pan till last, anyway. It always went from youngest to oldest, and there was never much left when his turn came. "You're tired and worried poorly," his mother said, and she handed him the icing pan. In the morning, the woman told the boy that she wanted him to walk to town, to the jail behind the courthouse, and take the cake to his father. "It's a troublesome trip," she said, "but they won't let women in the jail. So you must go." She tied a string around the cardboard box and said, "Carry it flat if your hands don't get too cold. Then it'll look mighty pretty when you fetch it to him." She stood at the edge of the porch until he was far enough away not to be able to look back and see her crying, then called to him, "Whatever you do, child, act perkish and don't grieve your father." On the road, the boy felt afraid. He had been to town at Christmas time before, not on Christmas Day, but a few days before, to help his father carry mistletoe and bunches of bittersweet berries that his father sold by the wall in front of the courthouse or on the corner by the bank. And sometimes, when it was getting late and they still had trimmings to sell, his father would go to the back door of houses along the street and say, "Ma'am, would you need some trimmings?" and hold up the biggest sprig of mistletoe left in his grain sack. They usually sold most of the mistletoe, the boy remembered, but bunches of bittersweet that the boy had carried all day were always left over to be thrown in a fence corner on the way home. "Ain't no good for nothing now," his father would say. From early fall until gathering time, the father and boy kept their eyes peered for the golden green clumps with white berries that grew high up in the forks of water elm and sycamore trees. Bittersweet was easy. "Pull down one vine and trim it, and you've got as much as a man can carry," his father would always say. "But it takes a heap of fearful climbing for mistletoe." They had already started gathering, and a half a grain sack of mistletoe was still hanging against the side of the cabin. If she hadn't had such a big load, she might have taken it, the boy said to himself. The boy's fearful feeling increased as he got nearer town. There were big houses, and behind the curtain windows there were eyes looking out at him. There would be more people now, and somebody might say, "What you got in that box, boy? Or where you going, boy?" Church bells were ringing in the town. It was Christmas, and some people went to church on Christmas. In town, the people he saw were laughing and talking. No one noticed him, and he was glad. He looked at the store windows out of the corner of his eye. They were silvery and gold and green and red and sparkling. They were filled with toys and beautiful things. With the Christmas money from peddling, his father had bought what toys he could for the boy and his little brothers and sisters. They had worn-out toys, too. People in the big houses where his mother worked had given them to her to bring home. He always wished they would give his mother an old book. He was sure he could learn to read if he had a book. He could read some of the town signs and the store signs. He could read price figures. He wanted to stop and stand and look straight at the windows, but he was afraid. A policeman would come after him. Perhaps the people had offered his mother old books, but she had said,
"No use. Nobody can read in our cabin."
Perhaps the people knew she couldn't read and thought her feelings would be hurt if they offered her the books their children had used up and worn out. The boy had heard once that some people had so many books they only read each book once. But the boy was sure there were not that many books in the world. It was cold, but there were a few people standing or sitting along the wall in front of the courthouse. Winter or summer, there were always people there. The boy wondered if they knew it was Christmas. They didn't look happy like some of the people he had seen. He knew they were looking at him, so he hurried quickly past and around the corner to the back of the courthouse. The front of the courthouse was red brick with great white marble steps going up to a wide door. But the back was gray cement and three floors high with iron bars over all the windows. The only door that led into the jail had a small square of glass at about the height of a man, and there were iron bars over the glass. The boy was not tall enough to see through the glass. He clutched the box close to him. He felt that something was about to burst through the door. In the middle of the door, there was a great iron knocker. The boy knew he had to knock at the door. He wished he could be back in the great woods. He could hear voices inside the windows with the iron bars. Somewhere, a voice was singing, "God's gone trouble the water." From one of the windows, there came the sound of laughter. Now and then a door slammed with a deep clash of iron on iron. There was a rattle of tin pans. The boy felt very lonely. The town was as lonely as the cabin, he thought. A large red-faced man opened the door and said,
"You'll have to wait. It ain't visiting hours yet. Who do you want to see?" "You have to wait."
And he slammed the door before the boy could speak. It was cold on the gray side of the building, so the boy went to the corner near the wall where the people and the visitors stood or sat. The sun was shining there. The boy had forgotten it was still Christmas. The waiting seemed so long. A drunk man staggered along the street in front of the courthouse wall saying, "Merry Christmas" to everyone. He said, "Merry Christmas" to the boy, and he smiled at the boy too. Finally, the great clock on the roof of the courthouse struck 12. It frightened the boy, because it seemed to shake the town. Now the red-faced man opened the door and let several people in. Inside, the man lined everybody up and felt their clothes in pockets. He jerked the cardboard box from the boy and tore off the top. The boy could hear iron doors opening and closing. Long hallways with iron bars from floor to ceiling ran from the door into the dim center of the building. The man with the red face squeezed the cake in his hands and broke it into four pieces.
"This could have a steel file or hacksaw blade in it," he said.
Then he swore and threw the pieces back in the box. The boy had been very hungry. Now he was not hungry. He was afraid. The man shoved the box into the boy's hands and swore again. Part of the cake fell to the floor. It was only a box of crumbs now. The man swore again and made the boy pick up the crumbs from the floor. The boy hated the man with the red face with the same total but helpless hatred he had felt when he saw his father chained, when he saw Sounder shot. He had thought how he would like to chain the deputy sheriff behind his own wagon and then scare the horse so that it would run faster than the cruel man could. The deputy would fall and bounce and drag on the frozen road. His fine leather jacket would be torn more than he had torn his father's overalls. He would yell and curse, and that would make the horse go faster, and the boy would just watch, not trying to stop the wagon. The boy would like to see the big red-faced man crumpled on the floor with the crumbs. Besides the red face, the boy had noticed the fat, bulging neck that folded down over the man's collar and pushed up in wrinkled circles under his chin. The bull neck of the man reminded the boy of the bull he had seen die in the cattle chute at the big house where his father worked. The horse doctor had been trying to vaccinate the bull in the neck, but the rope through the ring in the bull's nose didn't keep the bull from tossing his head from side to side, knocking the horse doctor against the side of the chute. Then the horse doctor had gotten mad and said, "Get a chain. I'll make him stand still." When the chain was snapped around the bull's neck, the farmhands pulled it over the crossbar of the chute posts and hooked it. But when the horse doctor stuck the bull in the neck, he lunged backward, set his front feet with his whole weight against the chain, and choked himself to death before one of the farmhands could jab him with a pitchfork and make him slacken the chain. The legs of the bull folded under him, and the chain buried itself in the fat of his neck. When the farmhands finally got the chain unhooked from the crossbar, the bull's head fell in the dirt, and blood oozed out of his mouth and nostrils. The bull-necked man would sag to his knees, the boy thought, and crumble into a heap on the floor, just the way the bull did, the boy thought, and blood would ooze out of his mouth and nose.
"Get up," the red-faced man said. "You want to take all day?"
The boy stood up. He felt weak and his knees shook, but there were no more tears in his eyes. The red-faced man took a big iron key on a ring as big around as the boy's head and unlocked one of the iron gates. He pushed the boy in and said,
"Fourth door down."
Passing the three doors, the boy could feel eyes following him. He saw men, some sitting on cots, some standing behind the iron gates with their hands on the bars, looking at him. Each step echoed against the iron ceiling and made him sound like a giant walking. Far down the long iron grated corridor, a sad voice was singing, "Far away on Judah's plains, the shepherds watched their sheep." The boy's father stood with his hands on the bars. He did not have his hands and feet chained together. Seeing the hands that could handle a hot pot lid without a pot rag, open the stove door without using a poker, or skin a possum by holding the hind legs of the carcass with one hand and the hide with the other and just pulling, the boy knew his father could have choked the cruel man with the bull neck. The father looked at the boy and said, "Child." On the way, the boy had thought about what he would say to his father. He had practiced talking about his mother selling kernels at the store and buying the cake makings, his little brother and sisters being all right, no strangers coming past, not finding Sounder's body. And he was going to ask his father where Sounder came to him along the road when he wasn't more than a pup. He practiced saying them all over and over to get the quiver and quiet spells out of his voice because his mother had said, "Whatever you do, child, act perkis, and don't grieve your father." But the boy was full of mixed hate and pity now, and it addled him. There was an opening in the bars with a flat iron shelf attached on the inside. The boy had left the lid of the box on the floor. Now he pushed the box through the opening and said, "This was a cake before..." But he couldn't finish. An awful quiet spell destroyed all his practice. "Sounder might not be dead," the boy said. He knew his father was grieved, for he swallowed hard and the quiet spells came to him, too.
"I'll be back for long," said his father.
From somewhere down the corridor there came a loud belly laugh, and a loud voice called out,
"Listen to the man talk."
"Tell her not to grieve,"
his father was almost whispering now.
"Sounder didn't die under the cabin,"
but the boy couldn't keep the quivering out of his voice.
"Tell her not to send you no more."
quiet spells were getting longer. The man stopped looking through the bars at the boy and looked down at the cake.
If he wasn't shot in his vitals, the boy said, he might get healed in the woods.
Then there was a long, quiet spell that was split in the middle by the loud clank of an iron door banging shut. Tell her I'll send word with the visiting preacher. The big red-faced man with the bull neck opened the corridor door and yelled, "Visiting over!" The boy felt numb and cold, like he had felt standing outside the jail door. He choked up. He had grieved his father. He hated the red-faced man, so he wouldn't cry until he got outside.
"Come on, boy," the man yelled, swinging the big key ring.
"Go, child," the father said.
"Hurry, child."
The boy was the last person through the big iron door. The bull-necked man pushed him and said,
"Get, boy, or next time you won't get in."
The boy moved quickly around the corner and out of sight of the iron door and the gray cement walls of the jail. At the wall in front of the courthouse, he stood for a while and looked back. When he had come, he was afraid. But he felt good in one way because he would see his father. He was bringing him a cake for Christmas, and he wasn't going to let his father know he was grieved, so his father wouldn't be grieved. Now the sun had lost its strength. There were only a few people loafing around the courthouse wall, so the boy sat for a spell. He felt numb and tired. What would he say to his mother? He would tell her that the jailer was mean to visitors but didn't say nothing to the people in jail. He wouldn't tell her about the cake. When he told her his father had said she shouldn't send him again, that he would send word by the visiting preacher, she would say,
"You grieved him, child. I told you to be pert, so you wouldn't grieve him."
Nobody came near where the boy sat or passed on the street in front of the wall. He had forgotten the most important thing, he thought. He hadn't asked his father where Sounder had come to him on the road when he wasn't more than a pup. That didn't make any difference. But along the road on the way to the jail, before the bull-necked man had ruined everything, the boy had thought his father would begin to think and say,
"If a stray ever followed ye and you wasn't near a house, likely somebody's dropped it, so you could fetch it home and keep it for a dog."
"Wouldn't do no good now,"
the boy murmured to himself. Even if he found a stray on the way home, his mother would say,
"I'm afraid, child. Don't bring it in the cabin. If it's still here when morning comes, you can take it down the road and scold it and run it so it won't follow you no more. If somebody come looking, you'd be in awful trouble."
A great part of the way home, the boy walked in darkness. In the big houses, he saw beautiful lights and candles in the windows. Several times, dogs rushed to the front gates and barked as he passed, but no stray pup came to him along the lonely, empty stretches of road. In the dark, he thought of the bull-necked man crumpled on the floor in the cake crumbs, like the strangled bull in the cattle chute, and he walked faster. At one big house, the mailbox by the road had a lighted lantern hanging on it. The boy walked on the far side of the road so he wouldn't show in the light.
"People hangs him out when company's coming at night," the boy's father had once told him.
When court was over, they would take his father to a road camp or a quarry or a state farm. Would his father send word with the visiting preacher where he had gone? Would they take his father away to the chain gang for a year or 2 years before he could tell the visiting preacher? How would the boy find him then? If he lived closer to the town, he could watch each day, and when they took his father away in the wagons where convicts were penned up in huge wooden crates, he could follow. The younger children were already in bed when the boy got home. He was glad, for they would have asked a lot of questions that might make his mother feel bad. Questions like,
"Is everybody chained up in jail? How long do people stay in jail at one time?"
The boy's mother did not ask hurtful questions. She asked if the boy got in all right, and if it was warm in the jail. The boy told her that the jailer was mean to visitors, but he didn't say nothing to the people in jail. He told her he heard some people singing in jail. "Sounder ain't come home?" the boy said to his mother after he had talked about the jail. He had looked under the porch and called before he came into the cabin. Now he went out, calling and looking around the whole cabin. He started to light the lantern to look more, but his mother said,
"Hang it back, child. Ain't no use to fret yourself. Eat your supper. You must be famished."
He said not to come no more, the boy finally said to his mother when he finished his supper. He said he'll send word by the visiting preacher. He poked up the fire and waited for his mother to ask him if he had been perk and didn't grieve his father, but she didn't. He warmed himself and watched a patch of red glow the size of his hand at the bottom of the stove. He could see the red-faced man lying on the jail floor with blood oozing out of the corners of his mouth. After a long, quiet spell, the rocker began to squeak, and it made the boy jump. But his mother didn't notice. She began to rock as she picked out walnut kernels. She hummed for a while, and then she began to sing, like she was almost whispering for no one to hear but herself.
"You gotta walk that lonesome valley. You gotta walk it by yourself. Ain't nobody here gonna walk it for you."
In bed, the pressure of the bed slaps through the straw tick felt good against the boy's body. His pillow smelled fresh, and it was smooth and soft. He was tired, but he lay awake for a long time. He thought of the store windows full of so many things. He thought of the beautiful candles in the windows. He dreamed his father's hands were chained against the prison bars and he was still standing there with his head down. He dreamed that a wonderful man had come up to him as he was trying to read the store signs aloud and had said, "Child, you want to learn, don't you?" In the morning, the boy lay listening to his mother as she opened and closed the stove door. He heard the damper squeak in the stovepipe as she adjusted it. She was singing softly to herself. Then the boy thought he heard another familiar sound, a faint whine on the cabin porch. He listened. No, it couldn't be. Sounder always scratched before he whined, and the scratching was always louder than the whine. Besides, it was now almost 2 months later, and the boy's mother had said he might be back in a week. No, he was not dreaming. He heard it again. He had been sleeping in his shirt to keep warm, so he only had to pull on his overalls as he went. His mother had stopped singing and was listening. There, on the cabin porch, on three legs, stood the living skeleton of what had been a mighty coonhound. The tail began to wag, and the hide made little ripples back and forth over the ribs. One side of the head and shoulders was reddish-brown and hairless. The acid of the oak leaves had tanned the surface of the wound the color of leather. One front foot dangled above the floor. The stub of an ear stuck out on one side, and there was no eye on that side, only a dark socket with a splinter of bone showing above it. The dog raised his good ear and whined. His one eye looked up at the lantern and the possum sack where they hung against the wall. The eye looked past the boy and his mother. Where was his master?
"Poor creature, poor creature," said the mother and turned away to get him food.
The boy felt sick and wanted to cry, but he touched Sounder on the good side of his head. The tail wagged faster, and he licked the boy's hand. The shattered shoulder never grew together enough to carry weight, so the great hunter with the single eye, his head held to one side so he could see, never hopped much farther from the cabin than the spot in the road where he had tried to jump on the wagon with his master. Whether he lay in the sun on the cabin porch or by the side of the road,
The one eye was always turned in the direction his master had gone. The boy got used to the way the great dog looked. The stub of ear didn't bother him, and the one eye that looked up at him was warm and questioning. But why couldn't he bark? He wasn't hit in the neck, the boy would say to his mother. He eats all right. His throat ain't scarred. But day after day, when the boy snapped his fingers and said, "Sounder, good Sounder," no excited bark burst from the great throat. When something moved at night, the whine was louder, but it was still just a whine. Before Sounder was shot, the boy's mother always said, "Get the pan, child, or feed your dog, child." Now she sometimes got the pan herself and took food out to Sounder. The boy noticed that sometimes his mother would stop singing when she put the food pan down at the edge of the porch. Sometimes she would stand and look at the hunting lantern and the possum sack where they hung, unused, against the cabin wall. The town and the jail seemed to become more remote and the distance greater as each day passed. If his father hadn't said, "Don't come again," it wouldn't seem so far, the boy thought. Uncertainty made the days of waiting longer, too. The boy waited for the visiting preacher to come and bring word of his father. He thought the people for whom his mother washed the soft curtains could certainly write and would write a letter for his mother. But would someone in jail read it for his father? Perhaps none of the people in jail could read, and the big man with the red face would just tear it up and swear. The visiting preacher might write a letter for the boy's father. But how would it get to the cabin, since no mailman passed and there was no mailbox like the boy had seen on the wider road nearer the town? The boy wanted to go to the town to find out what had happened to his father. His mother always said, "Wait, child, wait." When his mother returned laundry to the big houses, she asked the people to read her the court news from the newspapers. One night she came home with word of the boy's father. It had been read to her from the court news. When the younger children had gone to bed, she said to the boy, "Court's over." And then there was one of those long, quiet spells that always made the boy feel numb and weak. "You won't have to fret for a while by seeing him in jail. He's gone to hard labor." "For how long?" the boy asked. "It won't be as long as it might. Folks has always said he could do two men's work in a day. He'll get time off for hard work and good behavior. The court news had about good behavior in it. The judge said it." "Where's he going to be at?" the boy asked after he had swallowed the great lump that filled up his throat and choked him. "Didn't say. The people that has the paper says it don't ever say where they're going to be at, whether it's the county or the state. Ain't never outside the state, the people says." "He'll send word," the boy said. Now the cabin was even quieter than it had been before the loneliness put its stamp on everything. Sounder rolled his one eye in lonely dreaming. The boy's mother had longer periods of just humming without drifting into soft singing. The boy helped her stretch longer clotheslines from the cabin to the cottonwood trees at the edge of the fields. In the spring, the boy went to the fields to work. He was younger than the other workers. He was afraid and lonely. He heard them talking quietly about his father. He went to do yard work at the big houses where he had gathered weeds behind his father. "How old are you?" a man asked once when he was paying the boy his wages. "You're a hard worker for your age." The boy did not remember his age. He knew he had lived a long, long time. And the long days and months and seasons built a powerful restlessness into the boy. "Don't fret," his mother would say when he first began to talk of going to find his father. "Time's passing. Won't be much longer now." To the end of the county might be a far journey, and out of the county would be a far, far journey, but I'll go, the boy thought.
"Why are you so feared for me to go?" he would ask, for now he was old enough to argue with his mother. "In Bible stories, everybody's always going on a long journey. Abraham goes on a long journey. Jacob goes into a strange land where his uncle lives, and he don't know where he lives, but he finds him easy. Joseph goes on the longest journey of all and has more troubles, but the Lord watches over him. And in Bible story journeys, ain't no journey hopeless. Everybody finds what they're supposed to find." The state had many road camps which moved from place to place. There were also prison farms and stone quarries. Usually the boy would go searching in autumn when work in the fields was finished. One year he heard, "Yes, the man you speak of was here, but I heard he was moved to the quarry in Gilmer County." One year it had been. "Yes, he was in the quarry, but he was sick in the winter and was moved to the bean farm in Bartow County." More often a guard would chase him away from the gate or from standing near the high fence with the barbed wire along the top of it. And the guard would laugh and say, "I don't know no names. I only know numbers. Besides, you can't visit here. You can only visit in jail." Another would sneer, "You wouldn't know your old man if you saw him. He's been gone so long. You sure you know who your pa is, kid?" The men in striped convict suits, riding in the mule-drawn wagons with big wooden frames resembling large pig crates, yelled as they rode past the watching boy. "Here, boy, looking for your big brother? What you doing, kid? Seeing how you're gonna like it when you grow up?" And still the boy would look through the slats of the crate for a familiar face. He would watch men walking the line, dragging chains on their feet, to see if he could recognize his father's step as he had known it along the road, coming from the fields to the cabin. Once he listened outside the gate on a Sunday afternoon and heard a preacher telling about the Lord loosening the chains of Peter when he had been thrown into prison. Once he stood at the guardhouse door of a quarry, and some ladies dressed in warm, heavy coats and boots came and sang Christmas songs. In his wandering, the boy learned that the words men use most are, get out, and keep moving. Sometimes he followed the roads from one town to another, but if he could, he would follow the railroad tracks. On the roads there were people, and they frightened the boy. The railroads usually ran through the flat, silent countryside where the boy could walk alone with his terrifying thoughts. He learned that railroad stations, post offices, courthouses, and churches were places to escape from the cold for a few hours in the late night. His journeys in search of his father accomplished one wonderful thing. In the towns, he found that people threw newspapers and magazines into trash barrels, so he could always find something with which to practice his reading. When he was tired, or when he waited at some high wire gate, hoping his father would pass in the line, he would read the big lettered words first, and then practice the small lettered words. In his lonely journeying, the boy had learned to tell himself the stories his mother had told him at night in the cabin. He liked the way they always ended with the right thing happening. And people in stories were never feared of anything. Sometimes, he tried to put together things he had read in the newspapers he'd found and make new stories. But the ends never came out right, and they made him more afraid. The people he tried to put in stories from the papers always seemed like strangers. Some story people he wouldn't be afraid of if he met them on the road. He thought he liked the David and Joseph stories best of all.
"Why you want them told over and over?"
his mother had asked so many times. Now, alone, on a bed of pine needles, he remembered that he could never answer his mother. He would just wait, and if his mother wasn't sad, with her lips stretched thin, she would stop humming and tell about David the boy, or King David. If she felt good and started long enough before bedtime, he would hear about Joseph the slave boy, Joseph in prison, Joseph the dreamer, and Joseph the big man in Egypt. And when she had finished all about Joseph, she would say,
"Ain't no earthly power can make a story in as pretty as Joseph's. 'Twas the Lord."
The boy listened to the wind passing through the tops of the tall pines.
He thought they moved like giant brooms sweeping the sky. The moonlight raced down through the broken spaces of swaying trees and sent bright shafts of light along the ground and over him. The voice of the wind in the pines reminded him of one of the stories his mother had told him about King David. The Lord had said to David that when he heard the wind moving in the tops of the cedar trees, he would know that the Lord was fighting on his side and he would win. When David moved his army around into the hills to attack his enemy, he heard the mighty roar of the wind moving in the tops of the trees, and he cried out to his men that the Lord was moving above them into battle. The boy listened to the wind. He could hear the mighty roaring. He thought he heard the voice of David and the trampling of many feet. He wasn't afraid with David near. He thought he saw a lantern moving far off in the woods. And as he fell asleep, he thought he heard the deep, ringing voice of Sounder rising out of his great throat, riding the mist of the lowlands. When the boy came home after each long trip in search of his father, the crippled coonhound would hobble far down the road to meet him, wag his tail, stand on his hind legs, and paw the boy with his good front paw. But never a sound beyond a deep whine came from him. The bits of news he might bring home his mother received in silence. Someone had heard that his father was moved. Someone had been in the same work gang with his father for 4 months last summer on the Walker County Road. When she had heard all he had heard, she would say, "There's patience, child, and waiting that's got to be." Word drifted back that there had been a terrible dynamite blast in one of the quarries that had killed 12 convicts and wounded several others. His mother had had the people read her the story from the newspapers when she carried the laundry. None of the prisoners killed was the boy's father. The months and seasons of searching dragged into years. The boy helped his mother carry more and more baskets of laundry to and from the big houses. The clotheslines grew longer and longer. The other children, except for the littlest, could fetch and tote too, but they didn't like to go by themselves.
"Time is passing," the woman would say. "I wish you wouldn't go looking, child."
But when one of the field hands had heard something, or when somebody had said that a road camp was moving, she would wrap a piece of bread and meat for the boy to eat on the way and say nothing. Looking back from far down the road, the boy would see her watching at the edge of the porch. She seemed to understand the compulsion that started him on each long, fruitless journey with new hope. Once, the boy waited outside the tall wire fence of a road camp. Some convicts were whitewashing stones along the edge of a pathway that came toward the gate near where he stood. One might be his father, he thought. He could not tell until they got closer, for they crawled on their hands and knees as they bent over the stones. He leaned against the fence and hooked his fingers through the wire. If none of them was his father, they might know something anyway, he thought. He wished they would stand up and walk from one stone to the next. Then he would know his father easily by his walk. He could still remember the sound of his footsteps approaching the cabin after dark. The easy roll of the never-hurrying step that was the same when he went to work in the morning and when he came home from the long day in the fields. The boy had even been able to tell his father's walk by the swing of the lantern at his side, but none of the men, whitewashing the round rocks that lined the path, stood up and walked. They crawled the few feet from stone to stone, and crawling, they all looked the same. Suddenly, something crashed against the fence in front of the boy's face. A jagged piece of iron tore open the skin and crushed the fingers of one of his hands against the fence. Lost in thought and watching the convicts, the boy had not seen the guard who had been sitting under a tree with a shotgun across his knees get up and come to a toolbox filled with picks and crowbars which stood near the fence. The piece of iron lay on the inside of the fence at the boy's feet. Drops of blood from his fingers dripped down the fence from wire to wire and fell on the ground. The boy pulled his fingers away from the wire mesh and began to suck on them to stop the throbbing.
Tears ran down over his face and mixed with the blood in his hand. Little rivulets of blood and water ran down his arm and dropped off the end of his elbow. The guard was swaying back and forth with laughter. His gun lay on the lid of the open toolbox. His arms swung in ape-like gyrations of glee, and he held another piece of iron in one hand and his cap in the other. A white strip of forehead, where his uniform cap kept off the sun, shone between his brown hair and his sunburned face. His laughter had burst the button from his tieless shirt collar, and a white strip outlined his gaunt neck. For a second, he reminded the boy of a garden scarecrow blowing in the wind, body and head of brown burlap stuffed with straw, the head tied on with a white rag just like the white band around the guard's neck, the head tilting from side to side, inviting a well-placed stone to send it bouncing along a beam row. The men whitewashing the rocks made no sounds. No one among them suddenly raised himself to the height of a man almost as tall as a cabin porch post. "He ain't there," the boy murmured to himself. If he was, the boy knew by now he would be holding the scarecrow of a man in the air with one hand clamped all the way around the white strip on the skinny neck the way he had seen Sounder clamp his great jaws on a weasel once, with the head stuck out on one side of the jaws and the body on the other. And the man would wheeze and squirm like the weasel had. His legs would paw the air in circles like his hands. Then he would go limp, and the boy's father would loosen his grip, and the man in the brown uniform would fall in a heap, like when somebody untied the white rag that held the scarecrow to the stake. And the heap would roll down the slope and lodge against the fence, like the scarecrow rolled along a bean row until it caught in the brambles at the edge of the garden. Feeling defeat in the midst of his glee because the boy had not run but stood still and defiant, sucking the blood from his bruised fingers, the guard stopped laughing and yelled at him.
"That'll show you, boy. Get, and get fast."
The boy turned, and without looking back, began to walk slowly away. The guard began to laugh again and threw the scrap of iron over the fence. It landed a few feet from the boy. He looked at the iron, and he looked at the man. The white spot between his hair and his eyes was the spot. The iron would split it open with a wide gash, and blood would darken the white spot and make it the color of the man's sunburned face. And the stone that David slung struck Goliath on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face on the ground, the boy thought. But he left the iron on the ground. Still sucking his fingers, the boy looked once more at the men whitewashing the stones. They were almost at the gate. He didn't need to wait and ask. His father was not crawling among them. Later that day, passing along a street in a strange and lonely town, he saw a man dump a box of trash into a barrel. He noticed that a large brown-backed book went in with the trash. He waited until the man went back into the building and then took the book from the barrel. It was a book of stories about what people think. There were titles such as Cruelty, Excellent Men, Education, Cripples, Justice, and many others. The boy sat down, leaned back against the barrel, and began to read from the story called Cruelty. I have often heard it said that cowardice is the mother of cruelty, and I have found by experience that malicious and inhuman animosity and fierceness are usually accompanied by weakness. Wolves and filthy bears and all the baser beasts fall upon the dying. The boy was trying to read aloud, for he could understand better if he heard the words. But now he stopped. He did not understand what it said. The words were too new and strange. He was sad. He thought books would have words like the ones he had learned to read in the store signs, words like his mother used when she told him stories of the Lord and Joseph and David. All his life he had wanted a book. Now he held one in his hands, and it was only making his bruised fingers hurt more. He would carry it with him anyway. He passed a large brick schoolhouse with big windows and children climbing on little ladders and swinging on swings. No one jeered at him or noticed him because he had crossed the street and was walking close up against the hedge on the other side. Soon the painted houses ran out, and he was walking past unpainted cabins. He always felt better on his travels when he came to the part of town where the unpainted cabins were. Sometimes people came out on the porch when he passed and talked to him. Sometimes they gave him a piece to eat on the way. Now he thought they might laugh and say, "What you carrying, child? A book?" So he held it up close against him. "That's a school, too," the boy said to himself as he stood facing a small unpainted building with its door at the end instead of the side, the way cabin doors were. Besides, he could always tell a school because it had more windows than a cabin. At the side of the building, two children were sloshing water out of a tin pail near a hand pump. One threw a dipper of water on a dog that came from underneath to bark at the boy. The school was built on posts, and a stovepipe came through the wall and stuck up above the rafters. A rusty tin pipe ran from the corner of the roof down to the cistern where the children were playing. The dog had gone back under the building, so the boy entered the yard and moved toward the children. If one of them could work the pump handle, he could wash the dried blood off his hand. Just when he reached the cistern, a wild commotion of barking burst from under the floor of the school. Half a dozen dogs, which followed children to school and waited patiently for lunchtime scraps and for school to be over, burst from under the building in pursuit of a pig that had wandered onto the lot. In a wild chase around the building, the biggest dog struck the tin drain pipe, and it clattered down the wall and bounced on the cement top of the cistern. With the pig under the building and the dogs barking and racing in and out, the school day ended. 2 dozen or more children raced out of the door, few of them touching the 3 steps that led from the stoop to the ground. Some were calling the names of the dogs and looking under the building. The boy found himself surrounded by strange, inquiring eyes. Questions came too fast to answer. "You new here? Where you moved to? That your book? You coming here to school? Can you read that bigger book?" The boy had put his bruised hand into his pocket so no one could see it. Some of the children carried books too, but none were as big as the one he held close against his side. Just when the commotion was quieting down, a man appeared at the schoolhouse door. The children scattered across the lot in 4 directions. "Tell your pa that he must keep his pig in the pen," he called to one child. Then it was quiet. The boy looked at the man in the doorway. They were alone now. The dogs had followed the children, and the pig, hearing a familiar call from the corner of the lot, had come grunting from his sanctuary and gone in the direction of the call. In his many journeyings among strangers, the boy had learned to sniff out danger and spot orneriness quickly. Now, for the first time in his life away from home, he wasn't feared. The lean, elderly man with snow-white hair, wearing Sunday clothes, came down the steps. "This pipe is always falling," he said as he picked it up and put it back in place. "I need to wire it up. I just wanted to wash my hand. It's got dried blood on it where I hurt my fingers. You should have run home. Well, I don't live in these parts. Here, I'll hold your book, and I'll pump for you." And the mellow eyes of the man began to search the boy for answers. Answers that could be found without asking questions. "We need warm, soapy water," the teacher said. "I live right close. Wait till I get my papers and lock the door, and I'll take you home and fix it." The boy wanted to follow the man into the schoolhouse and see what it was like inside. But by the time he got to the steps, the man was back again locking the door. "I usually put the school in order after the children leave," he said. "But I'll do it in the morning before they get here." At the edge of the school lot, the man took the road that led away from the town. They walked without much talk, and the boy began to wish the man would ask him a lot of questions. When they had passed several cabins, each farther from the other as they went, the man turned off the road and said, "We're home. I live here alone. Have lived alone for a long time." Fingering the small wire hook on the neatly whitewashed gate, which led into a yard that was green, the teacher stopped talking. A cabin with a gate and green grass in the yard is almost a big house, the boy thought as he followed the man. Inside the gate, the man went along the fence, studying some plants tied up to stakes. He began to talk again, not to the boy, but to a plant that was smaller than the others. "You'll make it, little one. But it'll take time to get your roots set again." The boy looked at the white-haired old man, leaning over like he was listening for the plant to answer him.
"He's conjured," the boy whispered to himself. "Lots of old folks is conjured or addled."
He moved backward to the gate, thinking he'd better run away.
"Conjured folks can conjure you," the boy's mother always said, "if you get yourself plain carried off by this soft spell talk."
But before the boy could trouble his mind any more, the man straightened up and began talking to him.
"Some animal dug under the roots and tore them loose from the earth. It was wilted badly and might have died, but I reset it, and I water it every day. It's hard to reset a plant if it's wilted too much. The life has gone out of it, but this one will be all right. I see new leaves starting."
"What grows on it?" the boy asked, thinking it must be something good to eat if somebody cared that much about a plant.
"It's only a flower," the man said. "I'll water it when the earth is cooled a little. If you water a plant when the earth is too warm, it shocks the roots."
Inside the cabin, the man started a fire in the cook stove and heated water. As he washed the boy's hand with a soft white rag, he said,
"You must have slammed his fingers in an awful heavy door or gate."
Before the boy could answer, the teacher began to talk about the plant he must remember to water.
"You don't want to know nothing about me," the boy thought.
"When I saw your book, I thought you were coming to enroll for school. But you don't live in these parts, you say. I found a book in a trash barrel. It has words like I ain't used to reading. I can read store sign words and some newspaper words." "This is a wonderful book," said the teacher. "It was written by a man named Montaigne, who was a soldier. But he grew tired of being a soldier and spent his time studying and writing. He also liked to walk on country roads."
The teacher lit two lamps. The boy had never seen two lamps burning in the same room. They made the room as bright as daylight.
"People should read his writings," the man continued. "But few do. He is all but forgotten."
But the boy did not hear. He was thinking of a cabin that had two lamps, both lit at the same time, and two stoves, one to cook on and one to warm by. The man sat in a chair between two tables that held the lamps. There were books on the tables, too, and there were shelves filled not with pans and dishes, but with books. The mellow eyes of the man followed the boy's puzzled glances as they studied the strange, warm world in which he had suddenly found himself.
"I will read you a little story from your book."
The boy watched as the fingers of the man turned the pages one way and then the other until he found what he wanted to read.
"This is a very short story about a king named Cyrus who wanted to buy the prize horse that belonged to one of his soldiers. Cyrus asked him how much he would sell the horse for, or whether he would exchange him for a kingdom. The soldier said he would not sell his prize horse and he would not exchange him for a kingdom, but that he would willingly give up his horse to gain a friend. But now I have told you the whole story, so there's no use for me to read it. You've been a powerful good friend to take me in like this," the boy said at last. "My fingers don't hurt no more.
I am your friend, said the man. So while I heat some water to soak your hand and make your cot for the night, you tell me all about yourself. I had a father